Hello, everyone. Welcome to the fifth of the six lectures being given by the Slade Professor of Fine Art for 2021. As some of you will know, these lectures are an important tradition here at the University of Oxford. John Ruskin was the first to give a series of public lectures on art in 1870, after being appointed as the initial Slade Professor of Fine Art. Every year, a distinguished scholar is asked to follow in his footsteps. My name is Geoffrey Batchen, and I am Professor of the History of Art at the University of Oxford. It is my great pleasure to introduce this year's Slade Professor, Dr. Geraldine D. Dodds. Jerry Dodds is Harlequin Adair Darman Professor, Faculty of Art History at Sarah Lawrence College in the United States. Professor Dodds' scholarly work has centered on medieval Spanish art and architecture, and especially on issues of transculturation and identity formation. Among her many publications are Arts of Intimacy, Christians, Jews, and Muslims in the Making of Castilian Culture, a renowned co-authored textbook. In addition to her other books, catalogues, and essays, Jerry has also curated a number of important exhibitions and made informative films to accompany them. In 2018, in recognition of her exceptional contributions to the dissemination of knowledge of Spanish history and culture, Professor Dodds was the recipient of the Cross of the Order of Civil Merit from the Government of Spain. We are honored that Professor Dodds accepted our invitation to deliver this year's Slade Professor of Fine Art lectures, and I now happily hand over the microphone to her.
Thank you yet again, Professor Batchen, for your exceedingly kind words. My great thanks to the committee for the Slade lectures, for this honor, for the support of the Department of Art History, and to Liz Green and Holly Knights and the amazing Torch team. Alfonso X of Castile is called El Sabio, which ought to be translated more the learned than the wise. He's celebrated above all for his extraordinary cultural project, the construction of an ideal law code, the Siete Partidas, historical chronicles that drew on an erudite breadth of sources and languages, and he promoted the translation of texts with the notion of creating for Castile an elite secular culture in Castilian. His translation project included mirrors for princes, books on hunting, the Quran, the Talmud, and the Kabbalah, and above all, scientific texts, in particular, Arabic treaties, not just translated, but scientifically verified and updated. Because translation was also transformation, not simply the reproduction of a text in another language, but also the transmission of knowledge. The attention given by Alfonso's movement to Arabic learning is sometimes interpreted as part of a culture of inclusion. But for Alfonso, this was the recuperation of a continuum of knowledge into the cosmic dominion of the Christian intellectual tradition, a kind of intellectual reconquista. Translation became part of, in Pick's words, Christian expansion and self-definition. It was then appropriative, part of Alfonso's cultural imperialism in a way, an intellectual manifestation of a political goal he was not ultimately entirely capable of implementing in his world. So that when we see this much reproduced image of musicians from Alfonso's Cantigas, often interpreted as a Christian and a Muslim, although its racial stereotypes are contextually more complex, as I hope we'll see. We should not be beguiled into thinking it's so much a poster for a sentimentalized confessional convivencia as it is one for a pacified, expropriative cultural colonialism. Very dear to Alfonso's heart and a lively extension of the same policy was yet another cultural enterprise of tremendous scope. The Cantigas de Santa Maria, a book of 419 songs assembled around the last two decades of his life. It was written in medieval Galician Portuguese, an evolved literary language already in his time associated with love songs. Alfonso was an accomplished troubadour poet himself. You see him here dictating to two scribes as secular musicians and monastic singers wait in the wings. Indeed, he both formulated the collection and composed some of the poems, creating a persona for himself that he draws through the entire collection. In his introductory poem, he announces, "That which I seek is to praise the Virgin, Mother of our Lord, Holy Mary, the most wondrous of his creations. Therefore, from this day forth, I wish to be her troubadour, and I pray that she will have me. Hence, from now on, I sing for no other lady." So throughout these over 400 songs, Alfonso will take on the persona of the Virgin's troubadour in the language of courtly love. And in the language of courtly love, he will negotiate these same imperial ambitions with her. So today I'd like to talk about the Cantiga in honor of the Virgin's miracle in the city of Murcia. What is sometimes called the Murcia Cantiga is particularly compelling because Alfonso tells it himself in the first person, and it directly expresses his personal experience in that extraordinary colonial city. "I shall tell a great miracle," he says, "which I saw when God granted me Murcia. The miracle happened to an ancient church of the peerless queen, which stood there in the district of La Arishaca. The Moors had no power to do any harm whatever in that holy place, nor to remove the church from there, although it lay in their domain." The Cantiga presents Alfonso and us with a colonial dilemma. The city's Muslims have asked that a church be removed from a part of the city which by treaty was theirs. Can a Christian monarch countenance the destruction of a church, though he has made such a pact? In the miniatures of this codex from the Escorial, the story begins with an image of the Church of the Virgin in the suburb of La Arishaca, with its exterior wall cut away so that the cult image of the Virgin within is visible, seated on a high altar that seems more like a throne covered in textiles. The actual image is still venerated today, a very restored version of the 12th or 13th century Virgin of La Arishaca is believed to have been brought to the city at its conquest. And you can see how the artist of the Cantiga has captured the way she leans forward a bit, sheltering the Christ child in her lap. She's a throne of wisdom, Sedis Sapientiae, a late version of a Romanesque type, her antiquity, now in the 13th century, proclaiming her authority, as well as the historical veracity of the Cantiga. Not at all a painter's convention, since virgins in the Cantigas tend to be elegant Gothic mothers and queens. The miniature of the Virgin within the church at the heart of the city appears twice on the page, standing sentry to the contained agitation of the rest of the story. She's one with the building, and her archaic form and identification with the church remind us that she transcends changes in rule, that mere humans have, in the words of the Cantiga, no power to do any harm whatever in that holy place. So the urban and historical context deserve, I think, some explanation. Alfonso's father, Ferdinand III of Castile and León, seizing on the Almohad's dynastic weaknesses, had made conquests that would transform the face of the peninsula, taking the great plural cities of Andalus, Úbeda in 1233, Córdoba in 1236, and finally Seville in 1248, acquiring not only client states that paid tribute, but also new lands whose exploitation required a different economic model, direct colonial intervention bringing lively, diverse populations beneath the Castilian-Leonese banner. He expelled Muslims from Córdoba, hoping to repopulate the city with Christians with very questionable success, so a different strategy was attempted in the ancient stronghold of Murcia, taken in 1243. We've touched on Murcia often in these lectures. It's one of those places at times neglected because it seems peripheral to the seemingly clearer conflictual dramas caused by the great North African dynasties, the Almoravids and Almohads. We saw the transition of this border territory from Visigothic to Umayyad rule under the Treaty of Tudmir, which allowed the survival and abandonment of a church as it became a Muslim polity. And in the 12th century, as the former capital of the Wolf King, Ibn Mardanish, whose material culture had such an impact on Toledo and on Iberia's monetary system. At his death, Murcia would fall into the hands of the Almohads, and after their demise would be governed by Al-Mutawakkil ibn Hud, another charismatic, independent Muslim ruler who, like Ibn Mardanish, fabricated an Iberian Islamic identity in defiance of North African regimes. This made Murcia a place at once Islamic and ardently Iberian, though not, in Ibn Hud's time, terribly powerful. Like Ibn Mardanish, Ibn Hud was by necessity an occasional Castilian client and ally, which meant that he could be celebrated with approbation in the 13th century by Archbishop Rodrigo Jimenez de Rada as a ruler who, quote, cut off all the heads of the Almohads he could find, end quote, and who, interestingly, when he took the Almohads' towns, and I quote Rodrigo here, considering that all the mosques were infected by the presence of the Almohads, Ibn Hud had his priests purify them, sprinkling water. Now, for Rodrigo's very Christian readers, this was also a familiar scene because it sounded very much like a Christian purification and conversion, complete with priests, and it echoed a trope seated throughout his accounts of the Castilian colonial triumphs of Christian ceremonies of purification and consecration of former mosques into churches. In his triumphant account of the conquest and conversion of the Great Mosque of Cordoba, for instance, Rodrigo declares, quote, once the filth of Muhammad had been removed, it was sprinkled with holy water of purification and converted into a church. Ibn Hud had actually claimed that the Almohads were heretics, a concept that played well in Rodrigo's manipulated history, as it gave the archbishop license to develop an analogy with Christian practice that would not have been at all possible had Ibn Hud instead purified a church for conversion to a mosque. Connecting these passages regarding Cordoba and Murcia, Rodrigo made a place for this mythologized Ibn Hud, a Muslim who was a Castilian ally, the enemy of his enemy, in his utopian vision of a Christian-ruled world. But this was an evanescent image that was about to change. For though purification is the first and most essential component of a conversion ritual, asserting separate confessional identities, the body of a converted mosque, even a converted one like the great mosques of Toledo or Cordoba, continuously reenacted the impossibility of separate visual identities in a plural polity, as Cordoba still does today. One cannot entirely control the effects of the material discourse. So also, the mosque become cathedral of Toledo bore abiding witness to the diffusion of forms and their ongoing semantic transformation in a Christian world. The subject of Rodrigo's trope, linking his world and Ibn Hud's, is purification, and it summons its mirror image, contamination, revealing also the anxiety of that frontier breached, the tenuousness of such a web of order drawn over the unstable and chaotic colonization of Al-Andalus. And that connects perhaps to why Toledo's cathedral, still wrapped in the appropriated body of its former mosque, was now in the process of being converted to a Gothic building, and thanks to Tom Nixon for his reconstruction of that process in 1244. Borresi sees a surge in Gothic building in the 13th century as a way it was possible for northern cities that were now far from the frontier to militate. And indeed, James I famously attempted to motivate his see of Huesca in Aragon to replace its mosque building with a Gothic one, to build, in his words, an honest cathedral in a Christian style. And so, Archbishop Rodrigo Jimenez de Rada recounts in 1226, the king and the Archbishop Rodrigo placed the first stone of the Cathedral of Toledo that still conserved the form of a mosque since the time of the Arabs. We are moving perhaps from a habit of transculture to its erasure in the confessional realm. In 1243, as the transformation of the mosque cathedral of Toledo was underway, Ibn Hud's son, Muhammad ibn Hud, surrendered the city of Murcia to the young Prince Alfonso, and became a semi-independent vassal of Fernando's kingdom of Castile-León. Murcia, a vibrant Islamic city of a proud Islamic territory, had not been depopulated as Cordoba had. It retained its local king as the Castilian army took charge of its castles and defense. But political, religious, and economic affairs at first remained almost untouched. In this early conflation of feudalism and colonial dominion, Castile's Muslim clients were far from quiescent, but they were essential for the continuation of agricultural and mercantile economy, without which it would have been impossible to hold lands and realize much-needed revenue. Here, Prince Alfonso came into contact with the famous madrasa of Ibn Abu Bakr al-Rikiti, where Alfonso very likely learned Arabic. And he nurtured a religiously and linguistically diverse scholarly community that would provide a model for his intellectual enterprises to come. The Murcia Cantiga frames the story of its miracle within Alfonso's life, following over 20 years of his relationship with the city. He appears first as a prince wearing not a crown, but the biretta. And you can see here the biretta of his oldest son, Fernando de la Cerda, who died in 1275. And he's looking for all the world like the young Alexander, in whom he was deeply interested. This in a later 14th century drawing from the Libro de Alexander. Like Alexander, he was a ruler who, from his youth, governed a territory much larger than that to which he had been born, one with multiple languages, cultures, and confessions. And so I think here in part, he's constructing his own heroic narrative, beginning with his time in Murcia in the 1240s, just after his father had concluded the Treaty of Alcaraz. He recounts in the Cantiga that, although many times the Moors begged me to have the church removed, showing me it would be a good thing if they did, and their request was granted, it availed them nothing. The image of Alfonso as a prince depicts an orderly society in which submitted Muslims petitioned their sovereign from a position of mutually acknowledged subjugation. Enframed beneath one arch of a Gothic arcade, common to many of the Cantigas, Alfonso is both part of the narrative, the culmination of the attention of a group of kneeling Muslims, and also a frontal, iconic seated ruler. His gesture of acquiescence underscores the fulfillment of the pact between the Muslims and their Christian Lord, supporting their petition to destroy the Church of the Virgin as it, quote, lay in their domain. He's pictured as the just and pragmatic prince who understands that the productive interaction of peoples in a colonial setting demands binding obligation to his promises, despite the fact that the protagonists are not Christians, a prince governed by a dedication to justice. But there is, in the oppressively authoritative language of the composition, a sense of unease that we might read in the prince's frontality, juxtaposed with the constrained, kneeling knot of Muslims in profile. While Alfonso is enframed and unimpeded, the Muslims' compressed collective is bisected by a column so that they seem subtly caged, and one figure actually holds on to the column as if it were not a compositional convention, but physical bars by which they were restrained. This marks both the artistic and social confines within which Muslims must move in this representation of uncontested control. By contrast, even the Castilian guards and courtiers behind them are relaxed and unimpeded. It is an image of visual control that recalls Harvey's analysis of one of the meanings of mudéjar, domesticated. Indeed, when the historical Alfonso assumed the throne in 1252, he would move to exert personal control within his protectorate of Murcia, granting land to Christian settlers in violation of the Treaty of Alcaraz, which his father had made with his Murcian clients. This transgression would not be forgotten. In 1264, an uprising of submitted Muslims throughout Andalusia erupted in Murcia as well, in part through the stimulus of another feudal client of Alfonso's, Mohammed I, Ibn al-Ahmar, the ruler of the Emirate of Granada and founder of the Nasrid dynasty. But it was equally a response to Alfonso's gradual despoliation of Castile's treaty with the Murcians. in particular the redistribution of Murcian lands to Christian settlers in an effort to tip the confessional balance. The revolt was put down in 1266 by Alfonso's father-in-law, King James of Aragon, on behalf of Alfonso and in the interest of the security of his own bordering lands. In a new agreement with Murcian Muslims, James, who had more experience in maintaining such colonial relationships, granted them a number of the rights they requested. They could retain their goods, practice their religion, give the call to prayer, and be judged by their own courts, all concessions conceded in James's desire to return more. Created the main mosque of the city, dedicating it to the Virgin. Chronicling the number of mosques converted to cathedrals dedicated to Mary, Amy Riebensteiner laments that Santiago Matamoros, St. James the Moor Slayer, seems to occupy the imagination of scholars so exclusively, while the Virgin is really the most active of colonial conquerors. One might go on to differentiate these two sacred conquerors in this particular cantiga. While St. James will be depicted as a military leader in polarized opposition to the Muslims whose bodies lie at his horse's feet, the Virgin's position here is more ambivalent. She's a conqueror, to be sure, as Riemensteiner has amply shown, but she's a more subtle strategist. And this is perhaps why she's called into action in this complex moment in the conquest of Arab-ruled polities. James of Aragon himself recounts how Murcia's principal mosque was appropriated during the negotiations for the surrender of the city. After Mass, we climbed up to the castle, and he, the wazir, was with us and five of the chief Saracens of the city. We said that the mosque near to the castle should belong to the Christians, but they said that would not be right, for the treaties said they were to have their mosques and keep them just as in Saracen times. We said that was correct, but they did not understand. We wanted them to keep their mosques, but what were the Christians to do? They had no church to go to, and the church should be at the castle gate. For us to be able to hear the muezzin right by our heads every night while we were asleep is, if you think about it, not fitting. You have two mosques in the city, pray in them, and leave us this one. They said they agreed. It's questionable whether they had a choice. They had lost the terms of their original treaty in their revolt. It is then interesting that James, with both the muscle and legality square in his court, still felt the need to belabor this appropriation in his account. While the idea of a protected Christian minority is inscribed in Islamic law, contemporary Christianity viewed pluralism largely as an unsustainable state, the accommodation of challenge to the notion that Christianity holds uncontested truth. So that the existence of mosques in the protectorate was theologically dangerous terrain, while the creation of churches was essential to perform confessional transcendence in a plural city under the rule of Christians. James's comment that really it didn't make sense for him to have to hear the call to prayer is delivered with a certain swagger. And it has a history. It echoes a venerable trope reminiscent of the writings of 9th century Cordoban Christians who complained bitterly about the call to prayer, while the Umayyads assiduously controlled the ringing of bells in churches. In one of his devastating northern raids around 1000, Al-Mansur was said to have taken the bells from the church of Santiago de Compostela to Cordoba, where they were deprived of their clappers, silencing them to be reused as scaffolds for lamps in Cordoba's great mosque. This practice was continued by Almoravids, Almohads, and Marinids, which is why we find bells from Spanish churches fashioned into lamps in the Catawian Mosque in Fez, and why, if we're to believe Lucas of Tui, Alfonso's father, Ferdinand III, when he conquered Cordoba in 1236, sent Cordoba's bell lamps all the way back to the Church of St. James of Compostela on the shoulders of Saracens, continuing a dialogue that had reverberated on both sides of the confessional divide for centuries. And when this same James of Aragon took Valencia, the poet Ibn al-Mira, John Tolid reminds us, lamented that in his city the call of the muezzin would be replaced by the sound of bells. So James's directive is a trope and a taunt that whereas before Murcian Muslims had been able to control this space and its sounds, they would now forfeit oral control of the city. He's rubbing it in. And he's also documenting his relief. For though colonial rulers might countenance the presence of Muslims in their need to conjure uninterrupted economies, there was significant anxiety hidden in the appropriation of urban fabrics in which Muslims outnumbered Christians and possessed by treaty the right to their own religious monuments, the right to a material and oral manifestation of Islam in a Christian city. And yet, religious belief was not simply the symbolic terms in which a game of political one-upmanship was enacted. It's also good to remember that this is the same James, so full of bravado, who wrote about his personal feeling when he mounted an altar to the Virgin in the same newly converted mosque in Murcia. We heard it in the first lecture, but allow me to repeat it again. It was in Murcia that the great conqueror declared, embracing the altar, we wept so strongly and so heartily that for the time it takes to go a mile, we could not stop crying. The polysemy of conversion is not just about the body of the mosque converted to a church. It is also about the violent colonial project infused with deep belief. As King Alfonso X, surely equal in faith to James, if not in administrative skill, as soon as he took control of the city from his father-in-law, he revoked James's orders regarding many of the Murcian Muslims' rights, expelling them from the Medina to the suburb of La Arishaca, hoping to effect a repopulation of the city center with Christians. This enclosing and controlling of the population was not as practical for social stability and economic continuity as the Aragonese treaty of James had been. And indeed, the city became restive. Murcia's submitted Muslims would in the end still outnumber Castilians, Aragonese, and Catalan settlers, a colonial environment in which, Burns remarks, an overgrid of Christian settlers uneasily governed the conquered but restless Muslim majority. A condition that made political stability fragile and left a ravaged economy. But of course, Alfonso would tell a far different story in his retrospective Cantiga. The action of the next frame occurred over 20 years after the image of Alfonso as prince, and yet the Murcian Muslims are still frozen in the same kneeling posture, suspended in time, in identical subjugation, as if to assuage that demographic anxiety. Here the Muslims are shown petitioning King James I of Aragon following the uprising of 1264 when, quote, the Moors rebelled from Murcia to Seville, end quote. The Cantiga bypasses the complexities of the governance of Murcia following the rebellion, recounting only that James, quote, made the cathedral out of the great mosque, fixating on the theme of this particular Cantiga, which is confessional real estate. The Murcian Muslims ask again permission to have the Church of the Virgin removed to the suburb to which they've now been confined. And yet miraculously, although he consented to it, they could not touch a single nail of it. Alfonso X, now crowned as king, also acquiesces in the next panel. The Cantiga does not record his repudiation of James's pact with the Muslims or the forced exile of the Muslim community to the suburb of La Arishaca, called here their domain. These appear as stable, ahistorical circumstances within the entire discourse of the Cantiga. In each of these images of Muslim supplicants before a king, the Christian rulers embody a kind of timeless authority, while these historical Muslims, subjugated, constrained, and in profile, in potential movement, are evanescent. And yet, though the images are formulaic, Alfonso's written account is really quite personal for this moment, which falls during the years in which the Cantigas were written. He writes, after this, it happened that I went to Murcia, and most of the Muslim community asked me to remove the church from their midst, but I was loath to do so, for it had been freshly painted. However, very reluctantly, I granted their request. The juxtaposition of personal, even anecdotal experience, it happened that I went to Murcia and it had just been freshly painted, In the text, with the recurrence of the formal, authoritative compositions of the miniatures, marks Alfonso's attempt to reconceive his legacy as a just monarch. And yet Alfonso had in reality not upheld either Castile's original pact with the Muslims or those made by James, and his attempt at repopulation had greatly faltered. We can read a kind of slippage in the framing miniatures of the Virgin in her church, a visual echo of the dilemma of the Murcian Muslims in the face of this myth of order and control. The compact urban fabric, ringed tightly by crenellated walls, is made more dense and impenetrable by skewed roof lines and overlapping forms redolent of the constricted circumstances of the Muslims. A hint of empathy at their reduced circumstances, their justification for wishing to remove the church, which had attracted Christians from beyond the peninsula. Indeed, by the resettlement of 1272, Murcian Muslims lived in less than half the area they had previously possessed under the treaty accorded to them by James in 1266. But then the same image also depicts the Virgin's Church in the embrace of this compressed and displaced community of Muslims that had lost homes, property, and its own mosque. It envisions, as the triumphal text cannot, twin colonial dilemmas posed by the resettlement of Murcia: the subaltern sequestration and the colonists' anxiety in the face of their numbers and in fear of another revolt. And thus the panel of miniatures repeats its visual topos like an incantation for the subjugation and control of Muslims, one in which the scale of the church and the Virgin herself create a mythic vision of control. That control was increasingly impossible as Murcian Muslims were relegated to a sliver of land beyond the walls of the Medina. Alfonso's Roman law code, the Siete Partidas, which was never enacted in his lifetime, proclaims quite clearly that, quote, Moors shall not have mosques in Christian towns. The mosque which they formerly possessed shall belong to the king, and he can give them to whomsoever he wishes. And indeed, after the rebellion of the Mudejares, Alfonso conceded all the mosques that remained in the Medina of Murcia to Christian settlers. But the Murcia Cantiga drives home the paradox that belies the legal ideal. The Castilian colonial project required the maintenance of a pacified indigenous population of an alternate faith, in direct contradiction to a utopian Christian hegemony, which, unlike Islam, admits no alternative faiths. The final miniature of prostrated Muslims before a leader is structured by the same Gothic arches. They are on one hand palatial, but we begin to understand that they also signify the consistent structure of the law, of Castilian Leonese rule, in a frame emblazoned with the arms of Leon and Castile. Beneath the scaffold of that law, the kneeling Muslims make their pleas before their local authority, their own king, Alfonso's vassal in the 1260s. The text tells us that Alfonso had given them permission to destroy the church of La Arishaca, and then the community applied to their own authority to bring this about. All the Muslim community, the text reads, went to the Muslim king to ask him to have it done. But he said, I will not, for Mariam deals severely with those who displease her. The Muslims of Murcia wisely solve Alfonso's delicate problem, how to stabilize and rule a multi-confessional community by law, and at the same time serve the needs of the church, which cannot be held to terms of compromise as regards alternative faiths. The Virgin, apparently understanding Alfonso's dilemma, intervened to reestablish cosmic order where it is needed. Alfonso was certainly aware of the inclusion of the Virgin in the Quran and of Muslim participation in certain types of adoration of the Virgin, but the Muslim leader of the Murcian community who says, I will not, for Mariam deals severely with those who displease her, is rather acknowledging the Virgin's power as a frontier authority. As a colonial Muslim of Castilian desire, he recognizes her sovereignty. He sits beneath a single arch of the triple arcade, but unlike Alfonso and James, he sits in three-quarter view on a chair posed on a dais, a device that allows the painter to diminish the iconic implications of the frontal presentation of the Christian kings. And our gaze doesn't rest on the Muslim leader, but is deflected heavenward by his pointing finger. He is, like the other Muslims, more in profile, his authority contingent on his actions and ultimately fleeting. And then this panel reverses the direction of the other images so that we must read it from right to left, as if it were an Arabic text. Among the many ways in which this reversal works in the language of the composition is to remind us that this miniature depicts a different language of law, one to which Christians are not subject, but that nevertheless falls within the dazzling breadth of the Virgin's authority. It reveals the third space, the transculturative world within which Alfonso's most controlled of propaganda machines worked. Alfonso's cultural project endeavors to sweep every hint of ambivalence into the folds of the Virgin's cloak, to make all a purposeful part of her increasingly complex cosmos. Because the actual world was not in the consistent order that the miniature and the cantigas would like us to suppose, there is an urgency here to create images of subtly defined hierarchies that visually perform separateness, control of the boundaries between Christians and Muslims in the midst of their uneasy coexistence. But encased in that inverted composition is a palimpsest of ambivalence and some anxiety. There are, on one hand, a cantiga and a miniature that assume a common recognition of how the Arabic language is read and deploys this for meaning that betrays an understanding of the workings of local Muslim government, of the diverse legal positions that a Muslim might hold in Christian society, and an understanding that Muslims are a necessary part of this colonial state. They further acknowledge as within the possible order of things a situation in a colonial city in which a church might be destroyed in a Muslim neighborhood despite uncontested Christian identity. The image attempts to contain these colonial contradictions in an orderly structure, but they are so tightly packed, so disciplined and contained, that they betray chinks in the armor of the Castilians' actual ability to successfully colonize the city. In another of Alfonso's first-person accounts is the story told in multiple cantigas of his acquisition of a much-desired port, Alcanatir, or Alcanate in the cantiga, obtained, of course, in violation of his pact with the Muslims of Jerez, a fact predictably obscured by the text. In one cantiga, a powerful Muslim official, an alguacil, complained that Christians were calling the town by the name of Puerto de Santa Maria in contravention of their treaty. It must have sounded to him as if the Virgin were preparing an offensive, which indeed she was. The name of this cantiga is, after all, how Holy Mary took a place for herself in the kingdom of Seville and called it Puerto de Santa Maria. As in the Murcian cantiga, Alfonso goes to great lengths to uphold his pact, even violently punishing Christians who use this forbidden new Marian name. But in the end, under the persuasive influence of the Virgin, the alguacil yields both the city and its name, quote, to secure peace in the land, end quote. Here again, docile and wise Muslims yield rights and transgress their own boundaries in the name of peace. This laundered forensic history is also intimately intertwined with the miracles surrounding the creation of a new church. In three of the cantigas, the vision helps a mason, Master Ali, find a cache of stone when materials are needed. She creates a flood that brings wood to the very construction site and saves workers from a falling tower during construction. But the cycle in no place states what archaeology has taught us, that this church, in what is today the Castillo de San Marcos, was built within a converted mosque. A qibla wall marked by a mihrab was covered beneath plaster, while the church arcades reused spolia appropriated from the mosque's prayer hall arcades. The cantigas of Puerto de Santa Maria are entirely mute regarding the conversion, but they betray substantial slippage as regards the connection of the church to the mosque that was there before. The falling tower of Cantiga 364, many agree, must have been the minaret of the mosque. And the mason, Master Ali, with the prescience common to good Muslims in the cantigas, quote, realized that the Virgin had kept those stones like a treasure, although he was a Moor. And the miraculous stones themselves, quote, found just like that under the earth, good sized and neatly squared already, quote, hover like the intertextual specters of a pre-existing building willfully erased, transmuted from a mosque into a miracle, but still haunting the construction of the Church of the Virgin. Alfonso was not interested in this late literary fashioning of his legacy, in being known for converting mosque buildings into churches, as his father had, as Rodrigo recounted. He wished to be known for making churches anew. Alfonso did not begrudge James the conversion of the great mosque of Murcia. He wished to, as the Siete Partidas proclaims, make churches where there had not been any. Within these Gothic arcades, he sought to obscure the ambivalence of conversion in a dream of containment and eraser. And for this, he increasingly must rely on the Virgin to manage the impossible twin agendas of colonial conquest and the cosmic expectations of the domain of Christ. The final miniature in Cantiga 169 is a kind of postscript to the bulk of the story. Imbricated in the dense walls and towers, we see caricatured black heads and arms bristling with the tools needed to dismantle the Virgin's church. Behind them are three turbaned, light-complexioned Muslims, like the Murcian Muslims of the preceding miniatures, who watch the proceedings. The figures of the attackers are subsumed by the architecture of the scene, as if to depict their apparent insignificance in the face of the towering church. The text continues. Later, when Abu Yusuf, Lord of Saleh, passed by with a great army, the Moors thought to take Murcia by trickery in order to exalt their faith. However, the Holy Virgin undid their treacherous plot, and she drove them out of there. Therefore, now her church is free, for never can Muhammad hold power there, because she conquered it, and furthermore, she will conquer Spain and Morocco and Ceuta and Asila. This final image is set at the time of the Murid invasions of Andalusia in 1275, and the black-complexioned caricatures embedded in the city fabric are types for these foreign, non-Spanish Muslims. The Cantiga does not state that the troops of Abu Yusuf came to Murcia or attempted to dismantle the church, but the painter seizes on the idea as a way of picturing their impotence in the face of the Virgin's power. It's possible that the miniaturist is unclear which Muslims sought to take Murcia by trickery, the Murcian Muslims or the Marinids. But the artist nevertheless goes to great pains to distinguish between the two groups, the dark-complexioned figures with pickaxes and the turbaned, light-complexioned Murcian Muslims behind them. Although their complicity is implied, what is most interesting is their liminality, neither participating in the attempted destruction of the church nor maintaining a salubrious distance from the Marinid invaders. The painter sees their dilemma and expresses it in terms of race and dress. They are neither foreigners nor Christians. They are the famous Murcian Muslims, once independent Castilian allies, now sadly contingent and vulnerable, inhabiting a third space for which there will soon be no real place in Iberia, that of Iberian Muslim. The sculpture of the Virgin gives material credence to this miracle that took place scarcely more than a decade before the composition of this Cantiga. The Cantiga was perhaps meant to reassure Christian settlers that their appropriated land was under control, while Muslims were trapped in a splinter of territory beyond their walls. The Cantiga reminded them that they could depend on the Virgin to bridge the divide between life on the frontier and the cosmic expectations of sacred history. For who else but the Virgin can compel Muslim vassals, Murcian Iberians for over 500 years, to suppress their own interests, subvert their own agency, in the ultimate interest of a peace won at the price of their own erasure. Thank you.